In the late Middle Ages, I wrote a biography of Patrick White, novelist, playwright, agitator, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1973. His great novels, Voss, The Vivisector, The Tree of Man, The Twyborn Affair, aren't much read these days. It's a pity. But scholars are still exploring White's writing, not always with awe, but never doubting that reading him is an adventure. One of these scholars is Russ Karalis, translator, film buff, and, wait for it, the Sir Nicholas Laurantis Professor of Modern Greek and Byzantine Studies at Sydney University. Russ has just published a book on White's work called On Patrick White's Dilemmas. Reading it has taken me back nearly 40 years. Russ, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
How did I go with the pronunciation of Sir Nicholas Laurantis?
Very well.
Accurate. Who was he?
He was a great benefactor of the Greek community, first of all, that he, after he, with his, after his death, he gave a bequest, he left a bequest to the University of Sydney for a chair under his name of Modern Greek and Byzantine Studies. He was the first one who introduced cinema in Australia in 1901. He was one of the earliest settlers here in this country, and the one who took the itinerant cinemas around the countryside, the New South Wales countryside.
A man to be honoured.
A man to be honoured, and he was honoured indeed, because he was the first non-Anglo-Saxon who was knighted by the Queen in 1953. So ever since...
When she came out here, she put the sword on the
indeed,
shoulder.
Indeed.
And you now sit in his chair.
Now I'm sitting in his chair.
Russ, tell us how you first came across Patrick White's work in Greece as a schoolboy.
I was still in the year 9 or 10, I remember well, if I remember well, 10 probably. And when after he had received the Nobel, he was awarded the Nobel Prize, I found a Greek translation of The Tree of Man, which I started reading it. And I read it to my mother, to my grandmother and my mother, because as you understand, that was a period when most Greek migrants were coming to Australia here.
Oh, so they were curious about the nature of the country.
Who is this? Where is this Australia, they said. They didn't know where it was.
And you were reading Patrick White to them as a guide to Australia.
Exactly.
Yes, go on.
And they said, what is this now? Nothing happens in this book. Who is this man? You know, just nothing. You know, myself kept reading the book, and I found it so fascinating, so incredible, incredibly rich and nuanced, and so many interesting things that I've never experienced myself.
But Russ, you confess you didn't finish it at that point.
No, it was 700 pages long, you know, just, and I was only 16 years old.
But about 10 or 12 years later, you are, for some reason which is not completely clear to me, wandering around in the Netherlands.
Amsterdam.
How on earth did you come across his work again?
It was just lying in front of me in the streets. You know, this was an incredible coincidence. And I thought it was not coincidence. It was a predestination. You know, I'm thinking theologically and metaphysically, it was predestined for me to find all these books in Leidseplein in one of the central squares of Amsterdam there.
You don't mean just lying on the ground?
Just lying on the ground. English books for free, it said. And it was there, this incredible sort of a kind of collection of his books. Plus, there was the famous Atticus bookstore there, and had his American edition, the American editions of his latest books. You know, it's this incredible Knopf, you know, amazingly very beautiful and heavy.
Beautifully designed.
Deeply designed, and it's a sensual pleasure to touch this, the book itself. So this is what happened, this time, accidentally. And then I read Flaws in the Glass. One of the books that were there was Flaws in the Glass, where I discovered his connections with Greece. And I'm like, oh, this is my man. I said, now, this is what, I didn't know anything about that. You know, he had contributed to my education sentimentale without even knowing anything about him, about his work or his life and his biography. But then his biography made me read all of his books.
But you say in your book that you fell in love with him at that point.
Yes.
What was it that made you fall in love with that writing?
What I write in his writing, in all his novels, is that the way that he builds up characters and action, and finally, that's the dilemma that I discuss in the book, his English, his way of writing English, so dislocated, so interesting, so un-British, if I may say. So it was such a new understanding of how the language of the novel can contribute to a sort of a kind of aesthetic pleasure. And I read it simply for aesthetic pleasure. I didn't want to study him. I didn't want to do anything, write any books on him. I just started reading him for the sheer pleasure of reading his novels, which was incredible. You know, just when I started reading Voss, it was an ecstatic experience, first of all, because I have never felt like when I'm reading Graham Greene or the English, the British writers of that period, I found them very flat, boring, you know, just plot-driven, but they didn't have that mythical, you know, structure, substructure that Patrick White has, and they didn't take risks with the language. And Patrick White took risks with language. He pushed language to the limits. That's why I think he's one of the liminal writers that we have in English, and one who tests the ability of language to talk about the human condition, to speak out, to speak up about the human condition.
You write something that is absolutely chimes with me. You said that you found that he talked to me, in my native tongue. Now, English is not your native tongue, but I felt that too. I don't know. I can't remember which was the first book of his I read. I think it might have been Riders in the Chariot, but I felt that too. He spoke to me in my native tongue.
Well, these are the conditions that they have lived in. All these awkward, queer, and quirky people that I have met.
Contradictory. Stubborn.
Exactly. And erratic. Full of weaknesses. They celebrated their errors, their fallibility. They were ready to repeat them. They didn't have a virtue, sort of a kind of ethics of perfectibility and I will improve. And something that I liked... You never have this feeling for catharsis in his works. You know, the catharsis is actually in the narrative itself. The narration gives the catharsis. You don't have a closure. His novels end abruptly. I said, now, where am I now? And why?
and resolution may not have been discovered.
Never.
And salvation has certainly not been discovered.
Never.
And yes, yes.
And that's why because I have written about cinema as well, I found like Fellini's movies never have the word "the end" at the end.
I didn't realize that.
So because he wanted to show the continuity of his efforts, so he simply, the movie ended without the word "the end," which is sort of a kind of, it shows an Aristotelian understanding structure of myth and storytelling.
It just keeps going.
But it keeps going, and you have to add your own chapters to this. You are in there, and you don't know it. That's why it never ends, and you will never end. In the end, as he says, there is no end.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Russ Karalis about his book on Patrick White. Now, Russ, by another of the absurd chances of your life at that time, while you're on the train reading Patrick White in the Netherlands, you get an offer for a job in Sydney, to come to Sydney University.
Accidentally.
Oh, of course. Everything happens to you accidentally. I know people,
randomly.
I know people like you who claim that. So you arrived in Australia. Patrick White had died.
A year before.
So you never met the man.
Never met the man.
But you listened to the language you now heard being spoken around you. What was your impression then, impression now, of how we Australians speak English?
I love it. I mean, so irregular, so ungrammatical, so provocative. You know, as I say, it's a language, an oral language, an oral tradition in constant hybridization. You know, new words come in, new structures from other languages, and plays, and the wordplay that we see here. Also, the dryness, this distance, this Brechtian distance between what you say and the way that you say that. I'm not quite well, you know, which means... you're off your mumbles. You know, you've lost it completely. I'm not going. I remember the vice chancellor of the university said, "This person is not quite well. We have to look after him." Which I started laughing because in the beginning I couldn't understand what that meant. But then I got into the nuances of language. And I think Patrick White's language, especially the dialogues, because his descriptions are so evocative and so, if I may say, sort of rich in details, but the dialogues are so elliptic. The most important parts are missing from the dialogues.
Yes.
You know, you have to guess them. What are they trying to say here? You know, just, you know. So he had this uncanny ability of making me part of his narration by trying to understand, what is he talking about now?
Now, you say that one thing he did not understand was Greece.
Yeah.
His partner was Greek, Manoli Laskaris was Greek, but you say he did not understand Greece. Explain.
Well, he had a romanticized version of Greece, like Mr. Laskaris had a romanticized version of Greece, because for Mr. Laskaris, the Greece was a trauma, a lost motherland. He was evicted from Smyrna and Constantinople, then to Athens, and then to Alexandria, where he had to go away from there as well. And I think the Alexandria for him, Alexandria was a cosmopolitan city. You don't have roots in a cosmopolitan city. You have history, you have a story of your life, but never roots. This is not the place you want to die. You know, just, you know, you want to be buried because you don't have graves of your people there, you know. Most of the graves of his ancestors were in Athens or lost in Smyrna, as you know. But I think that Patrick White was a sort of kind of gave me a linguistic motherland, if I may call it, you know, just in English, that is,
yes,
to say.
Yes, yes.
And Mr. Laskaris helped me understand that, because in the beginning when I started, I met him, I said, I'm going to translate his books into Greek. I translated Vos and then Vivisector and one of his plays, A Cheery Soul, which was performed in Greece in 2004 Olympics.
How you did that, God only knows, but continue.
Yeah, and and Mr. Laskaris said, can't you ask something about me? Who am I? What am I doing here? That was a devastating question, as you understand. So he lived in a sort of kind of suspended temporality, suspended time. And he gave that perception to Patrick, because for him, for Mr. Laskaris, his motherland was Byzantium.
Yes.
Not modern Greece.
But don't you think that Patrick White absorbed something of Byzantium?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I praise in him always, in an essay I have written about him, The Great Code of Hellenism, and Patrick White in another essay, he avoided these classical fantasies that most Western writers have about Greece. I mean, if you remember, since you have published and edited his letters, he's in Athens, but he never talks about the Parthenon, except in a very, very strange position when he's in the toilet and sees the Parthenon from the toilet.
He's not there for the tourist spots.
No. He doesn't like that at all. And he never talks about these things. You know, he talks about the actual adventure of the people, but he romanticizes them. And he romanticizes the religion as well. He romanticizes the political adventure. We must not forget that after the war, you know, Greece came out of the civil war in 1949. The 50s was a period of heavy migration. Remember in the Night the Prowler, at the end we have the Greek migrants singing songs in Greek. And he had this idea that it was a country devastated by wars, migration, and the trauma of exile. Many people had to go because of this. And that's why he wrote in 1982, when we had the first socialist government in Greece by Andreas Papandreou, you know, Greece, my second country, if you remember in his essays. It was a very funny perception of Greece, of course, if I may say, for us, because for us, Greece is a torture. Not to say somebody is tormenting us every day. You know, when you say that you're Greek, this means, oh my God. But as Yorgos Seferis, the Nobel Prize winner of Greece, said, wherever I travel, Greece hurts me. It's an open wound, that is to say, the whole thing, Greece. But for him, it was this romantic area of resistance. He saw Greece as a place of resistance against occupation, foreigners, the Turks, first of all, and then the Americans, as he stresses in that essay. And he sees the spirit of resistance as the only way of defining themselves in history. That's why I said, you know, he was a bit, you know, the Greeks are very conformist. They're very, you know, in the end, they never managed to organize a revolution in the country. They never did anything, you know. They never. It took them 50 years to change a government, you know, just from a right-wing government to a socialist government.
Now, Russ, I'm going to force you now to go on to another huge subject.
Yeah.
In economical terms for the ABC listeners, your hatred of Protestantism. Now, I want you to explain the sources of this hatred, this distrust, a truly wicked tradition, you write, manifesting itself in all shades of black and deep blue, all degrees of depression and insanity. That is only one of the spots in your book where you get stuck into Protestantism. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, as you understand, like with Mr. Lascaris, coming from the Orthodox tradition, which is a mystical tradition predominantly, it's a tradition of mysticism, most of all, you know, the ineffability of God, the ineffability and the inability to interpret the word of God. I mean, the Protestants, and I think that conflict was in Patrick White already from the Ant story. The Protestant, as sort of a kind of, if I may say, titanic struggle to find the original texts of Christianity, the original meaning of what Jesus actually meant when he said that, and finally, did it really happen? The absence of the symbolic, that is to say, from the whole story of especially Lutheranism and Calvinism, and unfortunately these parts have come through to the Anglican tradition, which Patrick White was, I think, if you remember in his essays, is battling with, you know, he's struggling, he has an inner struggle there.
Yeah.
As I've actually discovered William Blake, I think the writer who has influenced more deeply than anybody else was William Blake, essentially, you know, this mystical version of pre-lapsarian Christianity, this contact with God before the fall.
But look, I'm going to get into the weeds a bit here, but there is something very different, isn't there? Maybe related a little, between Protestantism and Puritanism. And Patrick White was undoubtedly a Puritan.
A Puritan, yeah. But that's why I see the struggle in him. You know, he was exposed to this vision of orthodoxy, of Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, Eastern Christianity, by Mr. Lascaris, but his partner. And I think he was trying to reconcile these two in his. And that's why he says, in the end, I mean, it was the 60s and 70s, of course, we must remember that in the 80s, this Christianity and Buddhism coming together, it was a period of liberation theology, it was a period of. But I find the Protestantism I'm talking about in his works in particular, because, may I say something in secret, I became a Protestant for a period of time as well. I converted to Protestantism, confirmed by none other than Rowan Williams.
That's classy. That's classy.
Yeah.
Archbishop of Canterbury.
The Archbishop of Canterbury.
What happened to that? Didn't last?
No. No, I was very disappointed, I would say, you know, because I think that orthodoxy has a problem. Anything goes.
Yes.
You can't say this thing and deny it with another thing, and they'll be equally valid, both of them at the same time. On the other hand, Protestantism has a sort of, if I may say, and I think Patrick says that, a legalistic approach to things. You have to do things. I mean, they have
taken... You have to choose.
You have to choose. But we always make the wrong choices. And that's what Patrick White says in his novels. And that's why we understand the fallibility of humanity. I mean, that's the interesting thing about him, that he understood you have a vision of perfection, but you always fall short of it. You make mistakes. You deny it. You fight against it sometimes, even your own self, as you understand. And I think that Patrick White was one of the first... Should I call him theologians? No. But thinkers, because I think there's a lot of thinking in his novels as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I think not simply metaphysical, but cultural thinking about how we relate, if I may say, in this case, existentially, the one with in society. And that existentialist, we must never forget that it comes in the 50s with existentialism, although he hated Camus and Sartre and this kind of, and even Iris Murdoch. I mean, there is a lot of existentialism in him, sometimes with affectionate mockery. He makes fun of these things,
yes.
Which is really, I think it's a redeeming feature in his works. He makes fun of the things he finds interesting.
Yes, it's something that's overlooked, how funny the man was and how funny about himself
he was.
Cruel about himself as well as funny.
I mean, some of his novels are parodies of his own style, which I find it one of the most liberating elements of his work. He's the only writer I have, because I've read many writers from all over the world, is the only writer who dares to make fun of himself, not to take himself seriously. He announces things, that's why they call him this Baroque. It's not Baroque writing, and essentially his writing is a sort of a self-parody. He makes parody of his own beliefs, which means, essentially, that he's on both sides of the spectrum. Within the belief and outside the belief.
Yes, yes. And his mockery of himself is not to get out of it, but to acknowledge his failings.
Acknowledge his failings and acknowledge that I may be wrong. You know, he has that undoctrinal approach to things. He doesn't want to indoctrinate people with his writing. He doesn't put forward arguments. He explores questions. And that's why I call the book on Patrick White's dilemmas. He works on dilemmas. He never gives answers.
Now, look, biographers like me put quite significant weight on the fact that he was homosexual,
yeah,
and that how he lived with that, never deny, never explain, what it made him think of himself. In my reading of your work, you place much less weight on his homosexuality than a biography like me does.
Because I take it for granted. I mean, I don't question his, because I think it's not homosexuality or heter, it's sexuality. He sees things his sexual point of view. And I think that he arranges life around that one. That's why I don't accept the word homosexuality, because there was a book written that's saying that he took Nobel because of a homosexual cabal around the planet.
I haven't heard that. That's splendid. Keep going.
Yeah. That's essentially, he became famous because he was gay and other people were gay and finding him interesting, so they wanted to promote him, which is, I find it really, bizarre.
That isn't how it happened.
And it's in the end, it's bigotry, if we call it today. I find his sexuality that permeates the whole thing. Only, if I may generalize, only a gay person could have seen life from this point of view, from that angle. Because he was marginalized, he was afraid to declare who he was until very late in his life, although for those of us who could read and interpret the signs, the whole thing was there from the beginning, already from the
Happy Valley.
Of course,
he never hid.
From the Happy Valley, already there, you could see this arrangement of narration that goes back to, if I may say, to other relates and makes references, invokes other homosexual writers in a very subtle way. We have to talk about the 40s and 50s now. It was a period that would have been a reason for persecution, as we all remember or know.
Now, the truth is that Patrick White takes time to read, time to talk about, and we're running out of time.
Yep.
So I want to ask a couple of quick questions.
Yeah.
For somebody who has never read his work, what is the book that you read to find your way in?
Voss. I think Voss is the book that is the best, because he combines both his narrative, if I may say, artistry, the dexterity, and the psychological sort of kind of investigation of human character. And I think this is, and plus, they give us an amazing historical reconstruction of Sydney in the early days of the colony and in the early decades of the colony. And I think it's a book that I think it's one of them, a magisterial synthesis of stream of consciousness, Proustian recollection, and modern plot-driven writing of that period.
Okay, Russ.
And the second one, The Vivisector. If anyone wants to know what an artist is about, is The Vivisector. The book, I think, is the best book, together with Proust, In Search of Time Lost, that the best book ever written on artistic psychology.
Right. Okay. But in your book, you cite as the best thing that Patrick White ever wrote, the last lines of The Tree of Man, the book that made him famous when it was published in the 1950s. And those lines are these. So in the end, there were the trees, the boy walking through them with his head drooping as he increased in stature, putting out shoots of green thought. So that in the end, there was no end. And you found the model of those words.
Amazing, isn't it?
Isn't it?
You never expected that.
Where?
In St. Augustine, the city of God, the last paragraph, actually, of this huge volume by St. Augustine, which says, "There we shall be still and see, shall see and love, shall love and praise. Behold, what shall be in the end without end."
Russ, thank you for joining me on Late Night Live.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Russ Karelis, the Sir Nicholas Laurentis Professor of Modern Greek at Sydney University, film buff, translator of Patrick White, about his book on Patrick White's dilemmas, A Personal Essay. This is Late Night Live.